Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The Nazi Party was responsible for probably the most successful campaign in modern history. It convinced an entire population to mobilize for war and commit genocide against an entire ethnic group, whether or not they were fully aware of what they were doing. The propaganda campaign was so successful that it created an undying allegiance to Adolf Hitler even after he died. The German people were shocked when Hitler committed suicide in Berlin in April 1945. Some Germans felt angry and betrayed that the man who said that he would guide Germany to victory and create a thousand-year Reich would take his own life instead. And many people knew that the war was almost over at this point because German newspapers could barely print more than a single sheet due to paper shortages. Nevertheless, in an obituary in a Hamburg paper dated Wednesday, May 2nd, 1945, here's what it said about Adolf Hitler. He once said, "I wish nothing on my gravestone other than my name. Even his name will probably not stand over his grave, for we know that he must have perished while fighting bitterly in the Reich Chancellery. That his body is dead, we believe. What is mortal of him has perished, has passed away. But he has fulfilled his most beautiful oath, this affirmation. The most valuable thing God has given me on this world is my people. My faith rests on it. I serve it with my will, and I give my life to it. His life is fulfilled. Now the world will attempt to explain him. People will criticize him. People will pray for him. A great one has left this world. We swore an oath to this man and his teachings. We pledged ourselves to him during our people's dark days. We rose with him to the heights to which he led our people in the brief, beautiful years of peace, and like all good Germans, we stood by him in battle. We can confidently leave his judgment to world history. Will posterity be able to understand him fully? One can only hope that they believe the great words of the great man. Will they be able to understand why a whole people, in the midst of its deepest poverty, affirm this man? We see it in the silent, unspoken loyalty of the poorest sons of our people, Adolf Hitler gathered as a lens that focused all light on a single point. Little minds darkened the image of his clear will, that traitors and bad counselors deserted and betrayed him, that finally he was overcome by a great superiority of steel and money. That cannot change the image of him that is in the deepest heart of our people. He wanted the best for his people, which is why it loved him so much. We know that he will continue to live in our land not as a war hero in the form of a metal statue, but rather as a child of the people, whose pure will the people understood, and whose most beautiful words will remain a memorial for us, his words that in a people's deepest need, one must love his people more than himself." Well, that goes to show that even to the very end and after the end, there were people who stood by Hitler, and in retrospect, it seems obvious that people must have gone mad if they're talking so greatly to what just about everyone agrees is the 20th century, if not all of history's greatest monster. And this is more ironic in the context of Germany itself, whose philosophers and scientists did a lot to create the Enlightenment in the 20th century that we understand to today. Germany had the most refined educational system in the modern world, and I spoke in a previous episode about how the public school system in the United States was based on the Prussian school system, which Horace Mann, a politician, consciously copied when he traveled to Prussia and came back to the United States. So what happened? How was the Nazi propaganda program able to so successfully take arguably the most educated people on Earth at the time and make them so stalwartly supportive of someone that, obvious to an outsider, was a terrible monster? Whether or not your average German was aware of what was happening with the Holocaust, with the massive propaganda and anti-Semitism that was being pumped out day and night in leaflets and crude caricatures of Jewish people that looked like a horror movie poster, how did people swallow this and believe it so fervently? In this episode, I'm going to be looking at the Wehrmacht's propaganda troops, or Wehrmacht propaganda, the WPR, at the request of listener Nick Brooks, a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, the History Unplugged membership program, and all their activities and why they were so successful. So to do that, I'm going to be speaking broadly about the history of propaganda, how it was used differently in the age of mass communications compared to the ancient world and the Renaissance with printing presses, when in the modern world we have televisions and radio broadcasts and newspapers and other means of communication, and the theories of propaganda and how the Nazis were able to take it to new heights. Let's start out with what propaganda is. The word propaganda came into popular usage around World War I. But this isn't something that is new by any means at all and dates to far back before World War I. We can go back to the history of oratory, but one place we can trace the beginning of propaganda is Athens in ancient Greece. There were a group of Greeks who made up a citizen class that were conscious of their interests as a group and aware of the common problems they faced as a city-state. A class of Athenians wanted to mold popular opinion on issues of taxation and warfare and competitions with other city-states. Greeks had Olympic Games, the theater, law courts, the assembly, and religious festivals where one could express their opinions. Famous orators like Demosthenes argued that the Greeks should unite against Philip of Macedon. He was successful in his oratory, but his policy wasn't very good, and it led to the subjugation of Greek city-states. It wasn't just in political settings or courtroom settings, but also in Greek drama. Playwrights could use this forum for social and political and modern teachings. This is part of the reason that oratory was developed in ancient Greece in order to shape public opinion, and Greeks excelled at this. They didn't have anything like printing presses, but in order to spread opinion, the individual orator would have to physically be present to give a speech. And sometimes there were handwritten books that were circulated in the Greek world in order to shape opinion as well. Propaganda got a massive boost with the creation of the movable type printing press. Martin Luther published tract after tract against the Catholic Church, and the Catholic Church responded back. In fact, one of the first uses of the printing press was to print Catholic indulgences. So with this tract war circulating among Protestants and Catholics in Europe, it had a very religious use. In fact, some argue that the term propaganda has a close affinity with the term propagation, particularly in the sense of when, in 1622, Pope Gregory XV created the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith in the Catholic Church. This congregation was a commission of cardinals who were charged to spread the faith and relegate church affairs in what they called heathen lands. This was the Counter-Reformation, the reaction to the Protestant Reformation, where Catholic missionaries go out to places in the Middle East to try to convert Eastern Orthodox Christians to Catholicism. Pope Urban VIII set up the College of Propaganda to train priests for this mission. So this word had an honorable idea that you would propagate true belief. Trying to propagate true opinion goes down into the Enlightenment period, where Voltaire and Rousseau are trying to militarize opposition to Bourbon rule in France. In the American Revolution, with Thomas Paine writing about common sense, he's trying to organize opinion in the American Revolution. In the Balkan Wars in the early 20th century, something very popular were postcards depicting scenes of violence in which Turkish people would talk about the horrors and ravages of Balkan Christians against the Turks, and Balkan Christians would do vice versa. They would talk about how Muslim troops were trying to ravage them as well. So it isn't just officials getting into the propaganda campaign, but commoners too, trying to spread images that depict your opponent as monstrous. So by the time we get to the rise of the Nazi Party, we see that propaganda is something that's a mainstay and a fixture of modern-day nation-states. So what is it that the Nazis do that's different and makes them more successful? Nicholas O'Shaughnessy tries to answer this question in the book Selling Hitler, Propaganda and the Nazi Brand, and I think it does a good job of getting the essence of what was different. He and other historians would argue that the success of Nazi ideology can only be understood by the role of propaganda in the Third Reich, because what they did was create a religio-psychological phenomena, as he called it, which made propaganda especially powerful. Now, obviously, the Nazis didn't just use soft persuasion skills. The Nazis were a totalitarian fascist state, and they had rigged elections like in 1936, where the Reichstag and the referendum and the Rhine remilitarization required all Germans to listen to Hitler's speech from an arms factory at Essen. A press announcement at the time read, "The District Party headquarters has ordered that all factory owners, department stores, offices, shops, pubs, and blocks of flats put up loudspeakers before the broadcast of the Fuhrer's speech so that the whole workforce and national comrades can participate fully in the broadcast." The near 100% result of the vote was manipulated, and the Nazi Party clearly had their hands on the scale. But the Nazi Party also believed that internal assent had to be given. Joseph Goebbels, the minister of propaganda in Nazi Germany, said, "There are two ways to make a revolution. You can blast your enemy with machine guns until he acknowledges the superiority of those holding the machine guns. That is one way. Or you can transform the nation through a revolution of the spirit." Propaganda was the means of transforming the revolution of the spirit. And other Nazi Party members agreed. Albert Speer, Hitler's chief architect, said at the Nuremberg trial that what distinguished the Third Reich from all previous dictatorships was its use of all the means of communication to sustain itself and to deprive its objects of the power of independent thought. So propaganda was a kind of gospel of Nazism, and Goebbels liked to say that Jesus Christ has been a master of propaganda, and the propagandist must be the man with the greatest knowledge of souls. So he understood this quasi-religious element to propaganda, and Nazis utilized it fully. Hitler himself talked about theories of persuasion in Mein Kampf. The book is full of strange revisionist historical accounts and biographical extracts and speculations. But within it, O'Shaughnessy argues, there's a manual of propaganda in there that's pragmatic to the core. Hitler's insight was the recognition that violence and propaganda could be integrated and work together fully. He didn't disentangle war and propaganda from one another. And later on, after the war, Nazis claimed, "We didn't lose the war because artillery gave out, but because the weapons of our minds did not fire." O'Shaughnessy writes that the purpose of Nazi propaganda wasn't to brainwash ordinary Germans, and not to deceive the masses and make 2 + 2 = 5. The principal objective was, according to historian Neil Greger, to absorb the individual into a mass of like-minded people. And the purpose of the suggestion was not to deceive, but to articulate that which the crowd already believed. And so what it meant of giving voice to something that crowds already believe themselves, not turning 180, turning someone who was completely opposed to what the Nazi Party would offer, but to form and shape and give voice to opinions of people held in themselves, explains why Nazi propaganda could be so repetitive and seem simple at its core. And go back to the question at the beginning of this episode of how a seemingly educated culture that produced many of the most important philosophers and scientists of the 19th and early 20th century could be held sway by such simplistic propaganda. Goebbels argued that the skill of British propagandists during the Great War lay in the fact that they used just a few slogans and repeated them over and over and over. And Baruch Gitlis, a historian, argued that wherever the German turned, he met his most dangerous enemy, the Jew. That explains the simplistic anti-Semitism that occurs in Nazi propaganda, and that while he walked in the street, he encountered posters and slogans against the Jews at every square, on every wall and billboard. Even graffiti greeted the German at the entrance to his dwelling. "Wake up, Germany! Judah must rot." The purpose of this repetition, Goebbels said, was repeated exposure effect. The idea that the mass mind, the hive mind of society, is dull and sluggish, and for an idea to take root among them, it had to be reseeded over and over and over again. Comprehension in the mass mind couldn't happen unless it was constantly repeated, and repetition could facilitate this. So it wasn't so much about persuasion, but breaking down a victim and chipping away their resistance bit by bit by bit. What this would eventually do when someone was convinced or swayed or gave up against the message was that your audience would be internally committed, not just externally compliant to the message. The purpose of this kind of messaging was also to make reason submit to emotion. Goebbels and other Nazi propagandists thought that the nature of propaganda's appeal was to feeling rather than thinking, and the appeal to emotion lay at the heart of everything Nazis did. Goebbels thought that the role of the propagandist was to express in words what his audience felt in his heart. Hitler had the same type of sentiment, and he described appealing to a man's inner Schweinhund, the pig dog, the type of reactionary primitive part of one's nature. So that's why things are always presented in a binary Nazi propaganda. There will be either complete and total Aryan victory in a thousand-year Reich, or there will be the victory of the Jews and the complete destruction of the Aryan man. One Nazi theorist and proponent of propaganda, Walter Schulz-Wetzungen, wrote, "Many one laughed at the propaganda of the National Socialist German Workers' Party in the past from a position of superiority. It is true that we had only one thing to say, and we yelled and screamed and propagandized it again and again with a stubbornness that drove the wise to desperation. We proclaimed it with such simplicity that they thought it absurd and almost childish. They didn't understand that repetition is the precursor to success, and simplicity is the key to the emotional and mental world of the masses. We wanted to appeal to the intuitive world of the great masses, not the understanding of the intellectuals." So the idea was to speak the common man's language, not to get into arguments at the intellectual class that would be understood by few. The purpose was to speak to the working class, a bottom-up movement. And the fascists utilized mass media and marketing, and speaking the language of consumerism and even advertising, recognizing the role that the mass media played in the lives of the masses. Now, it's not as if everyone was swayed by their message, that everyone in Nazi Germany supported the Nazi Party with all their heart and souls. There were those who were convinced of the message, those who had their reservations, and those who doubted the message. And the Nazi Party never even broke 40% of the vote, even though they were Europe's most electorally successful European fascist party. But it was still successful enough to mobilize the nation to war that they very well prosecuted in its first few years. And this is why Hitler and his propaganda ministers had a need for a serial creation of enemies. And different enemies that were perceived by Nazi Germany of communists and gypsies and other people, bankers, were all rolled up into one super enemy, the Jews. This is a way that he could weaponize tribal passion and arouse emotions and render people vulnerable to his type of persuasion. Okay, so that was the theory of Nazi propaganda. How did it actually play out in the policies of the Ministry of Propaganda in terms of things like books and film and the banning of books and the banning of film? The Nazis established a rigid system of book censorship and had indices of undesirable books that lasted from the 1930s until the end of the war. Günter Louy lists all this in his book, Harmful and Undesirable, Book Censorship in Nazi Germany, and he notes that about 5,500 book titles were banned by the end of the war. The list was mainly made up by the Reich Chamber of Literature, and banned books include those of alleged moral corruption, works that support communism or Marxism or pacifism, and what is deemed to damage the martial spirit and morale of the German people and those propagating the Catholic faith or other non-Protestant confessional ideas, or really anything that failed to live up to what was to be expected in the new Germany. But especially books that were banned were equated with being Jewish, which was quintessentially un-German, according to Nazi ideology. After the Nuremberg Laws were implemented in 1935, but there were questions of what it meant to ban something that was Jewish. After the Nuremberg Laws were implemented in 1935, there were questions of, do you ban books or publishing houses that were owned by three-quarter Jews, half-Jews, quarter-Jews? And also, many of the publishing houses were Jewish-owned, so it meant a loss of publishing income in the 1930s with government taxation. But Joseph Goebbels said that culture triumphed economic need. And he noted that, quote, 40% of all German authors had been Jews who had developed their decadent and corrosive version of German literature in order to subjugate the German people, a step in the Jewish conspiracy to rule the world. So many Jewish authors were, of course, on the list of banned authors, like Franz Kafka, Franz Werfel, and others. The most notorious attempts to cleanse German literature had to do with Nazi book burnings. There were ceremonial book burnings in Nazi Germany and Austria in the 1930s. The books that were targeted for being subversive were similar to those that appeared on the list of banned books. They were written by Jewish, pacifist, liberal, anarchist, socialists, authors, and those who had nonconformist views of gender and sexuality. In 1933, the Office for Press and Propaganda of the German Student Union called for a nationwide action against the un-German spirit, the climax of what they called a literary cleansing by fire. Historian Karl Dietrich Brocker wrote, "The exclusion of left, democratic, and Jewish literature took precedence over everything else. Local chapters were to supply the press with releases and commission articles, sponsor well-known Nazi figures to speak at public gatherings, and negotiate for radio press time." At this and other meetings, students threw banned books into bonfires in ceremonies that include singing, oaths, live music, and incantations. In one festival in Berlin, 40,000 people heard Joseph Goebbels deliver an address, "No to Decadence and Moral Corruption," is what it was called. He said that the era of extreme Jewish intellectualism is now at an end. The breakthrough of the German Revolution has again cleared the way of the German path. The future German man will not just be a man of books, but a man of character. It is to this end that we want to educate you. As a young person, to already have the courage to face the pitiless glare, to overcome the fear of death, and to regain respect for death, this is the task of this young generation. And thus you do well in this midnight hour to commit to the flames the evil spirit of the past. This is a strong, great, and symbolic deed, a deed which should document the following for the world to know. Here, the intellectual foundation of the November Republic is sinking to the ground, but from this wreckage, the phoenix of a new spirit will triumphantly rise. Well, the book burning was an international controversy, and those whose books were burned responded back. Helen Keller published an open letter to German students, and she said, "You may burn my books and the books of the best minds of Europe, but the ideas these books contain have passed through millions of channels and will go on." And what happened to these authors, in addition to their books being burned, some of them went into exile, like Albert Einstein or Sigmund Freud. Others lost their citizenship, like Kurt Tucholsky, or they had to go into self-imposed exile. Some were sent to concentration camps due to the conditions of their imprisonment, or they were even executed. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. When these books were removed, they were replaced by books that promoted Nazi ideology, especially in schools. New textbooks were written that taught students obedience to the party, love for Adolf Hitler, and most of all, anti-Semitism. This was coupled with after-school meetings of the Hitler Youth and the League of German Girls to train faithfulness to the Nazi party among the youth, and celebrations like Adolf Hitler's birthday and the anniversary of his taking power essentially became holidays. Now, even though there was banning of books, authors had clever ways of trying to get around censors. If you wanted to be critical of the Nazi regime, you had to be clever, especially after the rise of Hitler in 1933. There arose Tarnschriften, or camouflage publications, which were a way to avoid German censorship in Germany between 1930 and 1945. There was an estimated 9 to 10,000 such publications that were produced in this time, which were issued with up to 40,000 copies per title, and about 80% of these were made by the Communist Party of Germany. One such book was titled A Treatise on the Latest Traffic Regulations for Cyclists. Another one was a guide on how to shield potatoes from frost. They were designed to be as boring as possible and as overlookable as possible. But one of these titles, on the inside, contained socialist and anti-fascist thought that talked about organizing a resistance against the Nazi regime. And other bits of content included some questions on the fight against Hitler's war policies and reflections on Spain and the duty of the German anti-fascists. And it also provided information on how to support political prisoners and their families, and to what extent it's beneficial to volunteer in official positions like a helper in an air raid shelter. Another book was disguised as an anti-Semitic work called The Foundations of the Jewish People, A Necessary Reckoning. But within the book, it contains an account of the persecution of Jews in Nazi Germany. And the camouflage part of these books were small compared to the bulk of the regular text. The anti-Semitic book has 188 pages, but the camouflage portion is only 22 pages. And the camouflage part is also smaller than the regular book, so it can easily be hidden in the pages of another book or slipped into a pocket. Now, let's get into film, because this is the other component of Nazi propaganda. Even before the rise of the Nazi Party in 1933, there were attempts to subvert the German film industry, which in the 1920s and 1930s was arguably the most advanced in the world. And in fact, many political refugees out of Nazi Germany went to Hollywood and helped build up that film industry and offer their technical expertise. On December 5th, 1930, Joseph Goebbels disrupted the premiere of a film. He and his stormtroopers disrupted the premiere of All Quiet on the Western Front, a film based on a novel of the same name. There, Nazi protesters threw smoke bombs and sneezing powder to stop the film. The novel itself had been unpopular with the Nazis, who thought that its depiction of the pointlessness and absurdity of war was against the German spirit. The film was eventually banned, and the director of the film emigrated to Switzerland in 1931, and his citizenship was revoked in 1938. The Nazi film policy was to show films in large cinemas with large audiences to affect the feeling of a crowd, going back to Joseph Goebbels' idea that the mass consciousness needed to be affected and steered, not just individual intellect and logic. What it could do was overwhelm the individual spectator, so that critical film perception would crumble. Film shows also took place in factories and military barracks, and the Hitler Youth arranged special film programs with newsreel and propaganda films shown. The Party Propaganda Department operated 300 film trucks to show films in rural and remote areas, and they carried all the necessary equipment for showing films in village inns, which was pretty technically advanced, bringing this equipment to small, rural, remote villages in the 1930s. Television signals existed in Nazi Germany, and Nazis wanted to use television as a medium for their propaganda, but there weren't enough television sets to be able to reach a large enough audience. And cinemas continued to operate throughout the war and up till the end of the war. Even after schools and playhouses stopped working in 1944, cinemas continued to operate, and in Berlin, anti-aircraft units were specifically posted to protect local cinemas. Joseph Goebbels wanted cinema to promote escapism, to distract the population and keep people in good spirits, because he believed that Germany was defeated in World War I because the morale of the people wasn't sustained. So this explains early propaganda films like Leni Riefenstahl's Triumph of the Will that records the Nuremberg rallies and shows thousands and thousands of soldiers in perfect line formation and an enormous crowd surrounding them. You also have anti-Semitic films like The Eternal Jew. Beyond promoting fictional films, there were also newsreels. The German Weekly Review was a series of weekly newsreels that were released in the cinemas of Nazi Germany from 1940 until the end of the war, and there were something like 755 released total. Newsreels would precede the main feature film, and these type of newsreels were also in Western Europe and the rest of the United States as well. After the Battle of Stalingrad, in which the German military was defeated and starts to recede, Goebbels thought that it was critical that the spirit of Germany be kept sustained, so he ordered an increase of efforts to manipulate the war reporting to keep up the perseverance of the German people. But he couldn't overwhelm eyewitness reports of soldiers via military mail, and of course what Germans were seeing with their own eyes with Allied strategic bombing on German cities. Well, to go back to our analogy that propaganda and war went hand in hand in the mind of the Nazi Party, propaganda campaigns were launched before military campaigns in 1939. Before Germany attacked Poland on September 1st, 1939, the Nazi regime launched an aggressive media campaign to build public support for the war. They played up what they called Polish atrocities, referring to physical violence and discrimination, whether real or imagined, against ethnic Germans living in Poland. The press and film depicted the Polish as warmongers and chauvinistic, and the Nazi regime also attacked the British for encouraging war by promising to defend Poland in the event of a German invasion. Nazis even staged a border incident to make it appear that Poland initiated the aggressive hostilities. On August 31st, in 1939, SS men dressed in Polish army uniforms staged an attack on a German radio station. The next day, Hitler announced that he would send troops to Poland in response to these incursions. The Nazi press office instructed the press to avoid the use of the word war. They were announcing that the German troops had simply beaten back the Polish attacks to make the Germans feel as if they were the victims of an aggression. And this would leave the responsibility for declaring war to the British and the French. The playing up of Polish atrocities fed into the Nazi marketing machine, and the press publicized attacks on ethnic German towns in Poland. There, fleeing Polish civilians and military personnel killed between 5,000 and 6,000 ethnic Germans, they claimed. And the numbers of actual ethnic Germans who were killed were always exaggerated. As the war went on and Germany continued to talk about ethnic German suffering, at the same time, the Nazi Party fabricated positive stories as part of their deception. A booklet published in 1941 represented glowing reports that German authorities in occupied Poland were putting Jews to work and building hospitals and building up infrastructure and setting up soup kitchens for Jews and giving them vocational training. At the same time that you have posters depicting Jews as fanged monsters sucking the blood of innocent Germans, posters and film and propaganda talked about all the good that Germany was doing to its subject population, and also continuing to make Germans feel like they were the victims, and reminding them that during World War I, there were false charges that Germans had cut off the hands of Belgian children, but despite these slanders and lies against them, the Germans were acting victorious in response. As Jews were being deported from their homes to ghettos or concentration camps, the perpetrators hid their intentions using propaganda again. The term that Germans used when they were deporting Jews was that they were being evacuated. They characterized these deportations as resettlements, as if they were going to the border of Germany in order to buffer up the population and defend the homeland, not that they were being sent to death. Well, Nazi authorities didn't want outside observers to see the concentration camps or ghettos and witness daily life for themselves, so they posted quarantine signs at the entrances warning of the danger of contagious diseases. But some of these warnings turned out true due to inadequate sanitation, water supplies, and the rampant outbreak of disease there. Nevertheless, there were still international observers who were hearing things about what the Germans were doing to their Jewish population. This led to the notorious propaganda hoax known as Theresienstadt. It was one of the most notorious efforts of deception that was established in November 1941 at a camp ghetto for Jews in Terezin in the Czech province of Bohemia. It was called Theresienstadt by Germans, and it was a ghetto for elderly and prominent Jews from Germany, Austria, and Czech lands as a transit camp for Czech Jews residing in the German-controlled area of Bohemia and Moravia. The Nazi regime publicized the existence of Theresienstadt and depicted it as a residential community where elderly or disabled Austrian or German Jews would quote-unquote retire and live out their lives peacefully. The camp was publicized for direct consumption within Germany itself, and people believing this propaganda caused many to be surprised by the discovery of the concentration camps after World War II, and for those who wanted to be willfully ignorant, it helped to have narratives like this to glom onto. The International Red Cross and the Danish Red Cross was able to get direct information about Theresienstadt in 1944, following the deportation of nearly 400 Danish Jews to Theresienstadt in 1943. And this was a carefully orchestrated visit. SS officials permitted Red Cross representatives to visit Theresienstadt. At this point, news of the mass murder of Jews had reached the world press. Germany was losing the war and losing control of the narrative. So SS authorities did a late-game hoax, accelerating deportations from the ghetto shortly before the visit, and ordered the remaining prisoners to clean up the ghetto. They had to plant gardens, paint houses, renovate barracks. When the delegation arrived, SS authorities staged social and cultural events for the dignitaries. After the Red Cross officials left, the SS then resumed deportations from Theresienstadt, which didn't end until October 1944, and they would be sent on to death camps. The Germans deported nearly 90,000 German, Austrian, Slovak, Dutch, Hungarian, and Czech Jews from the camp ghetto to the death camps in the east, and only a few thousand survived. 30,000 prisoners died in Theresienstadt itself, mostly from starvation or disease. At the beginning of this podcast, I looked at the end of World War II after Hitler had died, and how Germans were still not able to let go of who he was and the dream that he offered, and how the root of propaganda had burrowed in so deeply in the collective consciousness of Germany. Well, for those who heard the message, many held on to it very long. But in a way, it was believed by those who propagated the message, and when reality was contradicting it, they would simply ignore reality or not report on what was going on. We can look at this in the journal of Joseph Goebbels. At the end of the war, in 1945, his diary entries become fewer and fewer and are without emotion and are just simply reporting bare fact. The diary entry simply recounts what happened in the military situation of the day, and they're little more than status reports. The last entry was on April 9, 1945, that records on the progress of incoming Allied armies, and it says, "The enemy only made small gains. Ammunition situation is becoming difficult for the German side. Enemy air activity was particularly heavy. Our fighters were not in action." After Hitler committed suicide, Goebbels and the propaganda ministry announced his death on May 1st. It was accompanied by music composed by Wagner and Bruckner, considered German folk music. They tried to craft the narrative that not that Hitler had taken cyanide and shot himself as the Soviets were closing in on his bunker, but that he was fighting with his last breath against Bolshevism instead of taking his own life. And as the Allies uncovered concentration and death camps across Germany and Poland, there were German people who still believe in Hitler. And when they were asked about the camps, they said no, and proclaimed that Hitler, as much as he was anti-Semitic and as much as he was righteously fighting against the quote-unquote Jewish threat, he couldn't have created such places. They were fake. They were an Allied conspiracy. And when the truth of these places became irrefutable, and even those charged in the Nuremberg trials in high Nazi command fully acknowledged the concentration camps, the strategy wasn't to deny they existed, but to blame other people for them. And many Germans said that Hitler couldn't have created such places. It was Joseph Goebbels, it was Himmler, the SS, Hitler's other primary lieutenants, but not the man himself. Even at the end of the war, Germany was behind Hitler. But once a full truth came out, and Hitler's direction of the creation of the concentration camps and the 6 million that died as a result of him was incontrovertible, finally, the propaganda machine died. No matter how much the propaganda ministry was adaptable and influential and able to pound a repeated message that deluded people to the truth was happening, truth finally won out. After the fall of Berlin, Joseph Goebbels committed suicide, and the propaganda ministry was dismantled, along with the rest of the Nazi regime, as the war ended. All right, well, that's all for this episode, doing a deep dive into propaganda. Thank you so much for the question, and I really appreciate it.
Well, that's all I have for today. There's probably a million other things that could be said, but I think this is a good stopping point. First off, I want to give a shout out to the Spy Masters for the Knowlton's Rangers. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Marlene, Michael, Tim Clark, David Powell, Moondoggy from Ohio, Melissa, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, and Baron Fraser. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search our History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. And the last level is Spy Master, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, You can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.